This show is pre-recorded and furnished by Rowan, Gervy, and Wynn.
It's time for Gervy's Law, the intersection of law and life, with your host, injury compensation attorney, author, and mentor, Alan Gervy. Alan is managing attorney at the law firm of Rowan, Gervy, and Wynn, a workers' compensation law firm who have represented injured workers for over 35 years. Joined today by his co-host, radio personality, and television host, Carrie Kasem. Carrie brings a fresh, real perspective to the intersection of law and life, turning Murphy's Law upside down. And now, here are Alan Gervy and Carrie Kasem.
Good afternoon, Los Angeles, and everyone listening all over the world on KBC.com. I am Alan Gervy, the managing partner of the law firm of Rowan, Gervy, and Wynn. And today, on this wonderful Labor Day weekend, I am here to be the managing partner of your life. And Carrie Kasem is not here. She has the weekend off. I guess she's enjoying herself on this Labor Day weekend. But we have someone to sit in for Carrie that I'm excited to have on the show, as we've had her on the show for many times, many years now. And it's funny because Ann Bremner and I have never met in person. She's in Seattle. She's a high-profile attorney in Seattle, television commentator. She's been involved with so many important legal cases. She's the legal spokesperson for Friends of Amanda Knox, and she's a longtime prosecutor in the King County Prosecuting Attorney's Office. She was involved in the People versus Jackson case, Casey Anthony case she commentated on, Lacey Peterson, a lot of important cases. She has been named one of the top 50 women Washington super lawyers in 2019. She was one of the top 100 super lawyers, and she's been named on a number of different lists, number three of top five criminal defense lawyers, according to Lawrence Dworkin, and top 10 famous attorneys, sharing the list with people like Johnny Cochran, F. Lee Bailey, Alan Dershowitz, Robert Shapiro. And we've had all of those people on our show, except Johnny Cochran, of course. But we did have his successor at his firm, Brian Dunn. So we are in good company with Ann Bremner. Welcome back to Gervy's Law, Ann.
Well, it's such a pleasure and an honor. Thanks for having me.
You know, we're going to get to our guest because we have someone that I'm excited to talk to, and I know you are as well. But before we get to her, I do just quickly for a couple minutes, tell us a little bit about what you've been doing, because we see you in the news all the time representing Carmen Best, Seattle's police chief, and also with the recent verdict in the Susan Cox Powell case for Charlene and Braden, the client's grandchildren. Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, first, I represent Chief Carmen Best, who retired yesterday, and Seattle lit up major office buildings in blue in her honor, and even had in lights down one building with Love Best. I mean, she's just been wonderful for Seattle, and you know, it's been such an honor to represent her. And it's very sad she's stepping down, and the circumstances were untenable for her with defunding of the police by the city council. I won't go into all the details other than she's been phenomenal, 30 years in the Seattle Police Department, a real role model, a mentor, just a model of what everything we want to see in law enforcement. So, but she's on to some other things where she'll be educating, I think, and helping in ways that she can continue with her legacy, and just not as a Seattle police chief. And then the Susan Cox Powell case was a child welfare case where I represented the grandparents of Charlie and Braden Powell. My client's daughter was missing. Her husband was suspected of killing her, Josh Powell. CPS, Child Protective Services here, took those children into their custody when they had a whole lot of bad information about Josh Powell, that he was not a good or safe parent, and the kids were potential witnesses in that murder. And yet, CPS put those children along with their father, despite about 46 red flags that we told the jury about through experts and the fact witnesses. The children were conscious when their father hatcheted them to death, poured gasoline in their wounds, and set them on fire for at least 11 minutes, maybe 20, based on 911 calls and other fact witnesses. The jury awarded $98.5 million, basically $5 million for every minute of their suffering. So my clients are very gratified by the verdict, and they're going to use any proceeds to help other families across the country, as they've been doing in situations involving Child Protective Services. and also for domestic violence awareness and education and prevention. And then finally, to change the law in this state to enact Charlene Braden's law that says if a parent is suspected of killing the other parent or causing their disappearance, they cannot have access to the children.
Wow. You know, it's just heartbreaking to hear that. And congratulations for getting them justice, even though...
Thank you.
You know, the story just is so sad. And, you know, it's interesting because there's so many issues there. And maybe we can ask our guest, and I'm kind of keeping her as a secret. I'm going to let everyone know. But, you know... her new book that talks about forgiveness, and maybe this is an interesting philosophical question about forgiveness and the law. I don't think the book applies to situations like this. And then, you know, I know she has spent a lot of time advocating for children's rights and domestic abuse and other important issues that have really yes. become very, very important, especially during the pandemic, where we're hearing about all kinds of situations that are going on in the home. And, you know, I commend you for your work, and we will talk about it another time. We'll have you on, but now you're going to become an interviewer versus an interviewee. And it's funny yeah. because, you know, I see how Martha Minow, who we're going to talk about all her accomplishments. Well, there's too many to talk about, but she did say at one point that she enjoyed being an interviewer. So maybe, and we can get Martha to ask us questions during the next hour as well, because I think she might enjoy that. Martha Minow was the Harvard Law School Dean between 2009 and 2017. So many accomplishments for Harvard Law School during that period of time. She strengthened public interest in clinical programs, diversity amongst the faculty, staff, and students, internal disciplinary studies, and financial stability for the school. She is now the 300th anniversary university professor at Harvard. She's been teaching, and I know she smiles when she hears this, for almost 40 years, although she looks like she could never have been teaching that long. She has an amazing TED Talk that everyone should watch on forgiveness and the law. Her new book, When Should Law Forgive, that came out in 2019, has been really well received. She has been an expert in human rights and advocacy for members of racial and religious minorities and for women, children, and persons with disabilities. She's got a master's in education from Harvard, a JD from Yale, and probably her greatest accomplishment is that she has a husband, Joseph Singer, who is professor of law at Harvard as well, an accomplished violinist, and their daughter, Mira, is a writer and artist. Martha Minow, welcome to Gervie's Law.
I'm delighted to be here, and I'm not 300 years old.
No, of course not. But your school is.
Yeah, more, yes.
You know, it's funny because when you were given your introduction by Becca at the last lecture series in 2017, you said, wow, I wish my parents were here to hear that introduction. What did you mean by that, and how have you made your parents proud for all of your accomplishments?
Oh, that's such a lovely question. My parents, I'm so lucky, are still with us. They're in their 90s in Chicago. Living during this pandemic, they've learned how to use Zoom, which is wonderful. And they were my best teachers. They still are my best teachers. And they really emphasized pursuit of justice and kindness, which are watchwords for me every day.
You know, Anne, I know that you have spent a career helping people. You can identify with what Martha is talking about, and I think it does come from our backgrounds. When you have a solid foundation to build from, it really makes you practice law and teach law in a certain way. How do you see that? Go ahead with what Martha is talking about.
I was going to say absolutely, and I wanted to say, should we address you as dean and professor?
Martha is fine.
Martha, okay. I just want to say, you've got to be the smartest person in the room everywhere you go. I mean, your accomplishments are just so extraordinary. So I love what you've written and what you've done in amicus briefing. And I love that President Obama said that you changed his life at Harvard Law School. I mean, you've just done so much for so many people, and it's such an honor to speak with you. I guess one thing I was thinking of is that I really like your comparison with forgiveness in the criminal justice system and in looking at forgiveness, for example, of debt. That, and I wondered how you came up with that concept. It's so creative to say that, you know, you can have a bankruptcy and then start fresh. I mean, how did you come up with that? And then I haven't had the advantage of reading your book yet, but I did read the New Yorker article, your interview, and I just thought it was so brilliant. So I was interested in how the concept came about.
Yeah, that's very kind. I wrote a book in more than 20 years ago looking at legal responses, societal responses to genocide and mass atrocity. And I called the book Between Vengeance and Forgiveness because I really thought that vengeance could be devastating and lead to cycles of more violence. And forgiveness, I thought, was beyond the powers of most of us. But as I talked with people around the world, actually, about that book, many people said, well, why can't law forgive? So that led me to really look into that question. And if you do a search in any legal source about forgiveness, the word that pops up immediately is bankruptcy, not something that I had intended to study. But it was really because it's so well recognized in the law that forgiving debt is established. You know, it's even in our Constitution. It actually authorizes Congress to create a national bankruptcy law, maybe because Thomas Jefferson, as a founding father, was in debt so much in his life. But in any case, the role of bankruptcy and debt forgiveness in the United States is so well established. And there are studies that attribute the level of innovation and entrepreneurship in the United States to that, in fact. And then you contrast it with criminal law, which really was my motivation in many ways for writing this book, really concerned with mass incarceration in this country and with over-punitive responses to young people, particularly young boys of color. So I was looking for ways to find resources in society and in the law for forgiveness, and there it was. It was in the debt world. The idea of wiping the slate clean, giving people a second chance, those are the phrases that are universal, are present in all the legal treatments of bankruptcy and debt. And why can't we do that in criminal law?
You know, we have to take a quick break, but there's so many issues that come up. And, you know, so many of us will want to believe in that concept of forgiveness. It does beg the question, though, are people able to move on and act in a better way than they did when they were convicted of a crime? And that's something we need to look into after the break. You're hearing Gervie's Law right here on Talk Radio 790 KBC.
Welcome back to Gervie's Law, turning Murphy's Law upside down on Talk Radio 790 KABC.
Yes, we are spending Labor Day weekend with two very accomplished attorneys and one very accomplished dean. And I'd like to say that you're the dean of women attorneys in Seattle. I'm sure you are, but I don't think that's an official title. It's Ann Bremner. And by the way, I did mention that Martha Minauer, our guest, was married to a gentleman who, in his own right, has been a very accomplished professor and a violinist. At one point, and I know, Ann, you don't mind me saying this, because you were married to John Henry Brown, who represented serial killer Ted Bundy. And you know a little bit about this issue. And when we talk about forgiveness, as we were talking about before the break, referencing, of course, Martha's best-selling book, When Should Law Forgive? when you talk about someone like Ted Bundy, first I'm going to ask Ann and then we'll get to Martha. How do you find it in your heart to forgive, and how can we allow people to move forward when they probably should be punished for some very heinous acts?
Well, Ted Bundy is a prime example of where forgiveness, I think, it was not in the hearts of many of the families of the many women that he murdered over the years across the United States. And I was very interested in Martha's view of looking at circumstances like the child soldiers or the children in her Whitner case in Detroit, where she wrote the amicus brief, where you look at the circumstances of how somebody came to be involved in something that may be, unfortunate or criminal, or where one lacks education or access to education, et cetera. So you look at circumstances and then you say, this person was kind of catapulted into an unfortunate situation. And then you look at forgiveness. And I also thought about Clarence Darrow's speech in the Leopold and Loeb case, where he talked about tempering justice with mercy and forgiveness. And that I really thought of that argument that he made in that case, that I think he made for a couple of days, that kind of speaks to those issues in the criminal justice system. But I think also that, Martha, you would probably agree that there's certain cases you can't force forgiveness, of course. And there's certain circumstances where you're not looking at necessarily forgiveness in the case. And we do still have the death penalty, and we have purposes of punishment like retribution, rehabilitation, restitution, and deterrence. So we have to balance those things as well. And I'm interested in your thoughts.
Well, Anne, you're absolutely right. Some acts are unforgivable, and expecting individuals to forgive is itself at risk of another kind of victimization. To say mm-hmm. to a victim, not only were you injured, but now you must forgive, that's not even definitionally possible, because forgiveness by a person, I think, has to be voluntary. If it's coerced or pressured, it's not forgiveness, it's something else. But what I try to do is distinguish interpersonal forgiveness, which is, admirable, but not always appropriate, not always possible, from the forgiveness of a system. And so it seems to me not at all inconsistent for individuals to say, I want to see justice done. I want to see this individual held accountable. And at the same time to say, I personally forgive you. And just as it's possible for the individual to say, I don't have it in my heart to forgive, but for the legal system to say, okay, we have found you guilty, and now we're having a sentencing phase and deciding what's appropriate. And there some of those other circumstances may come into play. It's also interesting to me that many parts of the world, and increasingly even in the United States, there's an exploration of what people call restorative justice. So mm-hmm. here there's no pretense that people shouldn't be blamed or held accountable, but instead the focus is on, okay, now what do we do? What's the future? Typically in restorative justice, there's a confrontation, a meeting of the people who are charged with offenses and those who are directly and indirectly affected, and they work out some kind of an agreement of reparations or reconstruction or something like that. And it's forgiving in the sense that the individuals may not go to jail, but there is accountability, and I am all for accountability.
It's interesting listening to your answer. It made me think of family law, and I know you've taught some family law. And isn't that really the objective for couples who may be divorcing, to get them into a mediation or sit down and figure out what will work, especially when there's kids involved?
Absolutely, absolutely. One of the really saddest effects of the legal system that I have seen is the adversary system's exacerbation of the tensions between divorcing spouses, and particularly, as you say, when there are children involved. And I think there's a healthy move in many communities to prefer mediation and negotiation. If they have to somehow parent children together, getting them to testify against each other and amplify their differences is not going to be that helpful.
It's interesting, because that also makes me think of the talk you gave the last lecture series in 2017, when you addressed the issue of the art of asking good questions. And I believe so strongly in it. I've been a trial attorney for many years now, have asked so many questions, not only in trial, but also in discovery procedures like depositions, as well as with my clients. And it seems like lawyers are not doing as well with that. And maybe there are pressures. And when you talk about the family law system, you talk about forgiveness in criminal law. Do you think that maybe lawyers, and you would know because you've trained so many of them, including Barack Obama, but do you think there are pressures put on lawyers through law school and afterward through billing practices that really create almost an animal in what the lawyer's trying to do versus what you were talking about, which is really more compassionate, more rational, more objective? I saw somewhere where you said for a baby, your favorite baby gift used to be a T-shirt that says question authority.
Yes.
Maybe we're taking that too far, and maybe we're getting a little bit confused with our priorities. What are your thoughts?
Well, that's a very interesting perception, particularly from someone who's such an effective trial lawyer. You know, I think that trials have a place in addressing harms and getting at hidden truths, but it's only one tool of the law, and law itself is only one tool in society. I do believe that there are misuses of the tool of litigation in particular, and I think that there is an inadequate attention in law schools to other tools, including negotiation and mediation. I think no one should be afraid to go to trial when it's appropriate, but it's often to everyone's interest to actually devise a win-win solution. When I've had the good fortune to talk with people in other countries, it's interesting for me to hear people say in Europe, in Asia, you know, we want an American-style lawyer. And at first I didn't know what they meant, and I've asked this several times to people. And I say, we want someone who's interested in solving the problem, not just looking at the law and telling us what the answer is. And at its best, I do think that that's what our law schools equip people to do. But if they only have one tool, you know, it's like having a hammer, everything looks like a nail. And if you think everything has to be litigated, you don't have all the tools that you need.
Interesting. And I know you've had experience in this area. What are your thoughts? And maybe you can ask Martha, you know, because you are a few years out of law school, but still we may be less in touch than Martha is because she's seeing students every day.
Mm-hmm. Well, right. And I always think that trials are organized combat. You know, you can feel pretty bruised if you win or lose. I mean, I feel like, I don't know if you agree with this, Martha, but I feel like trial lawyers maybe only have five big trials in them. I mean, because it's a whole different life. I mean, my last trial was 5 weeks on, 5 months in hiatus from the pandemic, and 3 weeks of a socially distanced trial, the one I just talked about. I guess I'm interested in your thoughts about when you talk about restorative justice, which I agree is an excellent thought in terms of our system. But I also wonder about your thoughts on the vanishing jury trial and, you know, whether trials are becoming more and more rare in criminal and civil. I mean, we know that with most criminal cases plead out necessarily, otherwise the system would probably collapse. And then with civil cases, we have so much alternative dispute resolution alternatives that many, many cases settle. I think in my jurisdiction, 95% in state court and 98% in federal. And just interested in your thoughts, if that's a good thing. And it sounds like your thoughts would be it is a good thing to get away from this kind of trial structured system in criminal and civil.
The great philosopher Voltaire once said, I was never ruined but twice, once when I lost a lawsuit and once when I won.
I love that.
Which I think is pretty vivid.
Very
you know,
true.
No yeah, one has ever excellent. Been through litigation without being bruised. I think that is completely true. And a victory in litigation doesn't mean that there's no cost, financial, emotional, all kinds of costs. You know, it's not a blueprint for solving problems. It's a last resort. That said, I worry about the pressures, particularly in the criminal system, but it's also true in the civil system, where people settle or they plea bargain because of cost, because of time, because of abusive practices by prosecutors, because of fear. And I think that the jury is an admirable institution, though a very expensive one. And I just wish we didn't have people pressured to have a two-minute hearing about whether they should be evicted because they don't have the money to pay for a lawyer, or a two-minute plea bargain hearing about whether or not it was consensual.
Right.
I think that we have an image of the legal system from what goes on in TV or other kinds of media about the trial process, and most cases are not going through that process. And maybe that's good, but then we better have good alternatives. And at the moment, I think that the alternatives that are presided over by the court system are largely inadequate. I think that the development of alternative dispute resolution in the civil context is promising if there are equal resources available and well-trained mediators who don't have to be lawyers. And in the criminal context, again, I think that resolutions outside of court can be very good, but not if they're reflections of the underlying power relationships. And that can really lead to miscarriages of justice.
Yeah, no, I completely agree. I've had so many great experiences with alternative dispute resolution, with mediations, and I just can't understand why. Maybe it's the money. I don't know, but I can't understand why more disputes aren't resolved in that way, because it really does take away some of what you're talking about, the power brokering and other kind of nasty litigation techniques. Unfortunately, we have to take a break, but when we come back, we'll pick this up and we're going to talk to you a little bit about students, maybe even Barack Obama. And we'll continue our conversation with Martha Minow and Ann Bremner right here on Gervie's Law on Talk Radio 790 KABC.
You've heard of Murphy's Law, but have you heard of Gervie's Law? Anything that can go wrong can be made right. Now, here are your hosts, Carrie Kasem and Alan Gervie.
Well, it's not Carrie Kasem, it's Ann Bremner and Alan Gervie. And yeah, anything that can go wrong can also be made right. And we are speaking with Martha Minow, former dean of the Harvard Law School from 2009 to 2017. Clerked for Justice Thurgood Marshall of the Supreme Court of the United States, and David Bazelon of the U.S. Court of Appeals. We'll talk about that shortly. Also, Ann Bremner. And the two of them, when I think of Martha and Ann, I think of two attorneys with hearts. And it's so important for people to understand about caring, and that there are lawyers out there, professors, deans, who really are thinking about doing the right thing and actually doing the right thing, making things that are wrong right. Professor Paul Butler, who was a student of Professor Minow, Dean Minow, he's at the Georgetown University Law Center, described Martha the following way: compassionate, brilliant, wise, and gently provocative. I love that, gently provocative. And when Martha was introduced, the Harvard Law student Becca said she has unparalleled grace and curiosity and unfailing caring. These are really important attributes that lawyers don't usually hear about themselves. How does it make you feel when people are recognizing, Martha, the good in you and how you have been able to be so effective, but yet still having affect?
Well, it's very kind. I'm embarrassed by these very kind words, but as I referred to my parents earlier in our conversation, I was brought up to believe that kindness and decency are more important than brilliance or winning. And I think that one of the lessons of this pandemic for many of us is how important just day-to-day kindness is, and being gentle with one another. Life is hard enough. I am so lucky. I get to work with very talented and creative and motivated people, my students, my colleagues, my staff. But I also see such sadness and difficulties in the world. You know, I served for many years as the vice chair of the Legal Services Corporation, which is the largest funder of legal services for poor people in America. And in that role, visited a lot of courtrooms and a lot of offices where poor people are trying to get help when they're dealing with domestic violence or eviction or failures to get their veterans benefits or other situations. And you see the suffering and the challenges that people face. I mean, the least we can do is be kind to one another.
Yeah. And I know Anne feels the same way. She has devoted so much of her life to helping people. And we can hear about that in a moment from Anne. But you brought up the Legal Services Corporation. That is something that President Barack Obama appointed you to. How did that appointment go? And of course, was there any personal connection with respect to the fact that, as Anne pointed out earlier, that Barack Obama actually said in 2008, I had a teacher who changed my life, and that was Martha Minow?
Well, I think Barack Obama was on his path no matter who came towards him, but I was very lucky to have him as a student. I've had incredible students in my 40 years, you know, Loretta Lynch, his attorney general, Karen Freeman Wilson, who became the mayor of Gary, Indiana, Paul Butler, you mentioned, Paul Cappuccio became the vice president of Time Warner. I mean, just extraordinary and talented people, many whose names you haven't heard. President Obama was in a class of mine on law and society, and as I recall, he wrote a paper with a fellow student about the duties we owe to our fellow citizens. And we became friendly and stayed in touch. And when he ran for his first offices in the state government of Illinois, I was supportive. And then when he ran for the U.S. Senate, I was as well. And when he became president of the United States, I said the only thing that I wanted from him was a chance to have dinner with him, which instead he asked me to serve, as you noted, on this largest funder of legal services for poor people. It was created actually under the administration of President Richard Nixon. It's a bipartisan effort. It's always been bipartisan. It's supported by the American Bar Association because so many people, you know, in Texas, for example, 80 to 90% of people in family law cases don't have lawyers. So many people don't have access to lawyers and navigating the legal system when you are at risk of losing a child or losing your home or not getting benefits for when you're disabled, it can be devastating. So I, of course, said yes, I'd be happy to serve. And I learned a great, great deal. At this moment in the country, because of the pandemic, we're about to have a tsunami of evictions. And it's the low-income people, of course, who are hit the hardest by any natural disaster, and this is no exception. I did have the chance to co-chair a task force about tackling natural disasters for legal services, and I learned something very important, which is every other field and profession has emergency planning, preparedness for hurricanes and fires. Lawyers don't tend to do that. Courts don't tend to do that. And we need to do that. We need to be prepared because we're going to have disasters. We are having them. And to be able to know, okay, the courts are shut down, but if there's a need for child support payments, the courts still have to be open. We need preparedness for emergencies, and that's one of the many lessons I learned from my service on the Legal Services Corporation.
Wow, yeah, no, that's important. And I know, Anne, you probably have had the same experiences on a different level. Go ahead.
Yeah, go ahead.
No, Anne, go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, I was looking at Martha's
interest in increasing access to justice and working on educational equality. And I love your answer, Martha. I still want to call you Dean or something. Or I think you should become a saint or run for president. That's my vote. And I'm sure Ellen joins me. I know that you're considered, of course, for the Supreme Court, too. I mean, you're amazing.
Yeah, that's right.
But I think that you're doing such wonderful things just all the way around. But I think when you're talking about this disaster preparedness that we need to have, that's just brilliant. Because that's exactly right, spot on. And I think the pandemic has taught us all to be a little kinder to each other. Maybe that'll cause us to respond to the emergency.
You know, go ahead, Martha.
Well, I've gotten interesting phone calls and emails from several mayors, actually, during the pandemic, who have heard about restorative justice and asking me for advice. And I think that during this period, there's a lot of reflection going on by public officials, by people in private settings, saying, how can we do things better? How can we plan to, when we rebuild, to be better? And I hope there's more kindness built in and more forgiveness where possible. So I think, as terrible as this experience is for everyone, there might be some silver linings.
You know, it's interesting when you say that, and then I'm reflecting on Anne's comments that, you know, she wants to call you Dean, and I think that's very respectful. I would like to as well. But several years ago when I started doing this show, and I was interviewing all kinds of people from all walks of life, and professors, deans, congressmen, doctors, lawyers, actors, whoever, I decided that I was just going to call them by their first name. And no one has ever once said to me, you know, please call me Dean or Professor or Doctor. And I think it goes to what you're saying, Martha, the kindness, the connection, to be able to connect. Mm-hmm. We all have respect, I think, or hopefully, for people who have accomplished things and everything. And we do want to show that respect. But at the same time, there's got to be ways to connect and show how much we are all kind of alike, and we all have first names, and we can, and you know, you're showing us right now that you're just like us, even though, as Anne has said, your accomplishments are far greater than anyone that, you know, we typically come in contact with. But you're just one of us, and you're just trying to help people. You're just trying to get by, especially during the pandemic.
Well, we're all human beings. And I think, you know, at the core of the idea of rights or human rights is the idea that we're all human beings. We do share the basic commonality, basic dignity, and something that unfortunately gets lost in the times of division and dispute. But to remember that is so, I think, invaluable. Having the chance to teach is a good way to remember that over and over again.
Yeah.
I'm constantly being taught by my students. And so the idea that I should pull rank simply because I've been around longer, when I'm learning from them, you know, that really teaches me something yet again.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. We have to take a break, our last break, and then we'll have a few minutes when we come back. Martha, we're going to give you an opportunity to be the talk show host. I know you have talked about that, that you love asking questions. You love being a talk show host. So after the break, we'll give you a couple minutes. And you have to remember, you're under a time crunch here because we only have a few more minutes. And then I do want to ask you about students and the pandemic and how that's going at Harvard and what you expect to see moving forward. You're listening to Gervie's Law right here on Talk Radio 790 KABC.
Need some legal, moral, or just common sense advice from a friend? Call Alan Gervie and Carrie Kasem now at 800-222-KABC. That's 800-222-5222. You've heard of Murphy's Law, but have you heard of Gervie's Law? Anything that can go wrong can be made right. Now, here are your hosts, Carrie Kasem and Alan Gervie.
Yeah, we're back, and as usual, we're running out of time, so we got to go through the rapid round. We're talking to Martha Minow, former dean of Harvard Law School, the 300th anniversary university professor at Harvard Law School now. And before the break, Martha, I said that you have a chance to ask Ann Bremner and myself questions or a question. If you were a talk show host, what would you ask?
Questions for both of you. One is, do you advise people who ask you for career advice to become a lawyer? And what kinds of words of wisdom do you say about that? And the second question is, what is the moment in your career where you have felt the greatest satisfaction?
And?
I'm going to give that to you first, Alan.
No, I was going to. Okay. I'll take the first one, and then you take the first, and then I'll take the second one. So, yeah, that's a great question about what I would instruct people or tell people. It's funny because really quickly last year at this time, my son and daughter, my son's 7, my daughter's 6. Last year at this time, he held up a sign. He's going to first grade, and it said, "What do you want to be?" He said, "A lawyer." This year, he said, "I want to be a business owner and a football player." And I thought for a second, was I hurt by that? And then I realized I don't think I'm in a position to tell anyone what to do, whether to become a lawyer or not. I think it has to come from within. I'll be supportive of my son if that's what he's into, and my daughter if she's interested in it, but she isn't. She's going to be an artist, I think, like your daughter, Martha. But the fact, at 6 years old, I guess you don't know, but the fact is that I really will not dissuade anyone to be a lawyer, but I will be supportive, but I want it to come from the heart for them. I'm not going to tell them what to do. Anne?
So I get the second one. That's a great answer, as always, Alan. I think on the greatest satisfaction, I think that at least in my practice, I see people in crisis, and I try to get them to the other shore, get them to the other side in a better place. And I guess that's always my greatest satisfaction. And I love that Mark Twain quote, which is always do right. It'll gratify some and astonish the rest.
Yes.
And I try to kind of live by that. And it sounds, I know both of you do too. And I guess that's the satisfaction is when I get to the other side with my client that it was the right thing. And the right thing, whether it's a jury verdict or a decision in mediation or a resolution, that the right thing came down at the end, and that's my greatest satisfaction. It's happened over and over again, and I know it's happened over and again for both of you far more than it has for me.
Oh, don't say that. Not for me. But I'll tell you, I really appreciate your words, because doing the right thing has always been at the forefront of my thoughts. I studied philosophy when I was at Brown, and that was my goal, was to do the right thing. It was moral philosophy, and mm-hmm. I really believe that even lawyers can keep that as the most prominent thought in their mind with whatever they do. Excellent questions, Martha. I really appreciate it. Maybe when Carrie and Anne aren't available, you'll be co-hosting the show with me, because you've got
I'd be honored.
That'd be wonderful.
You have a knack for it, that's for sure. So before we let you go, let's talk a little bit about the pandemic and law students' remote learning. How's it going? I can tell you for my 6 and 7-year-old, it's not great. Tell us from your perspective and what we can expect moving forward, at least from the Harvard Law School perspective.
I think the toughest situation is for elementary school kids. I have a friend who's a kindergarten teacher, and this is really challenging. And I have nieces and nephews whose kids are all preschool or an elementary school, and they're trying to work from home, and the kids don't want to be on Zoom, and it's very, very hard. With college students and particularly law students, it's a very different situation. It's far from ideal. But they are responsible and motivated and absolutely giving it their all. That was true when we switched to virtual learning, remote learning in March, and that's been true even in some of the classes that I've just done in the last week. I'm just astonished by how focused the students are and how much outside work they've done. The harder part for us is to create those informal settings so much of learning in law school and in college is informal. You know, it's the bull sessions, it's after class. So how do we do that? Can we create settings for those kinds of informal exchanges? And we're working on that, and breakout groups and other kinds of conversations, whether online or even old-fashioned telephone. We'll get through this, and wonderfully, our students are trying to be helpful to other people. Our clinics are all in operation and working. I'm actually co-leading a colloquium series once a week on COVID and the law. And over 40 members of my faculty and staff are participating. They're all doing amazing work, whether it's on food and drug law during the pandemic.
Martha, where can we find? I actually am interested in reading about that. Is there anything online that I can look at with the COVID and the law?
Absolutely. We have a website and a blog that goes along with the colloquium, and I'll send it to you.
Yeah, if you could, because that sounds fascinating, and I would like to get that out here. We only have a minute. I'll ask you a real question, a yes or no, and I don't want to end on a down note, but what about tuitions for students? Should there be a rebate if it's remote learning? Or just a simple question, right? Or not?
Sorry, I can't give a yes or no. I can give the answer that I always advise law students when in doubt to give this answer. It depends.
I like that. Oh, yeah, you know, that's kind of a positive thing. It depends. The book is called When Should Law Forgive? It's a must read. Go online, get it ordered, because you probably can't go into a bookstore, at least here in LA, but get it ordered. It'll be delivered. When Should Law Forgive? Martha Minow, it's been a real pleasure having you on the show today, and thank you for spending the time with us.
Thank you both.
Anne Bremner, as usual, love having you here. Anytime when Carrie's not here, you're welcome to co-host.
Oh, I loved it, and I love speaking with Martha, and you're wonderful, both of you. Thank you.
Thank you, and everyone have a safe and great long weekend, and we'll see you next week.
You're here. Wonderful. Take care.
You too.
You too. Bye-bye.
You're listening to Gervie's Law, the intersection of law and life on Talk Radio 790 KABC.
This show is pre-recorded and furnished by Rowan, Gervie, and Wynn.